from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Democratic presidential candidate and South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg says that he has the right kind of experience for the nation's highest office. Buttigieg, who is 37 years old, openly gay, a Rhodes Scholar and a Navy veteran, is a rising star in the Democratic Party. Though he is currently considered a long shot for the nomination, Buttigieg would make history as the youngest and first gay man elected to the White House. He joins us in studio for this segment to discuss his presidential bid and his new memoir, The Shortest Way Home. Welcome, Pete Buttigieg.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, you got one of the things a presidential candidate needs. You got a book.
That's right. I was working on the book before I ever thought of doing this, but it's certainly helped us get a story out.
Well, and your story is really a compelling one. I mean, to be a millennial and to be an openly gay man and to be a Rhodes Scholar and to have been in the Afghanistan war and all the rest of that is really quite a profile. And even to have the name Buttigieg, which takes in, you know, a couple of big elements into it in terms of identity. Let's talk about what compelled you to do this. But before we do that, you actually launched a campaign in January, and you are now, even though you're against money in politics, you've got that strong progressive view. You need money for your coffers, really, to get thing going, to get recognized, really.
Yeah, no, you know, for better or for worse, it's still the case that they take your measure largely based on fundraising. Look, I don't have the gilded fundraising base that a senator from a coastal state might, but we've been really pleased to see grassroots contributions coming in. The decision to that we've made not to accept corporate PAC money, I think, will not hurt us that much in the long run, provided that we can demonstrate that grassroots support.
You only have to get up to 1%, which is where Kirsten Gillibrand is, right? You're presently at zero, but you have to get up to 1%.
I think we'll be able to make that. Of course, the DNC has also indicated that you need 65,000 unique donors in order to be invited to participate in a debate. So we've got our eye on that target, and we're asking everybody who's supporting me, or even everybody who just thinks it's worth having me on that stage, to consider making a contribution.
Well, I'm sure you'd love to be on that stage and get into a debate with the candidates, and so many have their hats in the ring right now. It's almost compelling just to see how many people have decided that they want to be the president of the United States. Why do you want to be the president of the United States?
Well, I think it's time for a new generation to put forward leaders. You know, I'm a millennial Midwestern mayor, so it's certainly not the profile you might expect in a conventional sense. But I actually
think, a red state, we should say.
That's right. Yeah, Indiana's a very red state. Home of former Governor Mike Pence, but also a state where I got reelected with 80% of the vote in our community, which is more Democratic, but not that Democratic. I mean, we got there by reaching across the aisle, working with people who are independent-minded, and not by pretending to be more conservative than I am, but by finding common cause and focusing on results. And I wish we had more of that in Washington right now. I also think the perspective of the Midwest is important at a time when my party, to its detriment, has really lost touch with the interior of the country, especially industrial Midwestern communities like mine, where generations of people grew up being told that success meant getting out. But there are also some really compelling things happening in our communities, and we need to make sure those are known so that the current president's message that the way to our hearts is resentment and nostalgia and impossible promises to turn back the clock, that there's an alternative to that.
I have a place in my heart for Hoosiers, by the way. I was just at a wedding in Indianapolis, and, you know, I grew up in Ohio next door, but knew a lot of people in Indiana. The irony of Indiana has always been, in my mind, the fact a lot of good folks there, you know, a lot of real kind of plain-spoken people and all the rest of it, because I think of myself as a Midwestern. But it's also a terribly racist state. And also, you mentioned Mike Pence. I mean, there's real homophobia in your state, too.
We certainly dealt with both of those things. The state's history with the Klan is
stronger than anywhere outside of the Deep South.
On the other hand, the first, in fact, the only president in the last 40, 50 years to turn Indiana blue electorally was Barack Obama. So, the big lesson I've learned is that it's not as ideological a state as you might think if you find ways to reach people. And the fact that, you know, Mike Pence was governor when I came out, that was during a reelection, and I still got reelected with a very healthy margin. So,
and former President Obama, we should mention, actually said some strong and favorable words about you, not necessarily as a candidate, but as a real up-and-comer in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, which I appreciate. You know, I think my generation of emerging figures in elected office and in the Democratic Party are fortunate that there's a relatively young ex-president who's decided that he's really interested in supporting the generation after him coming up. And I guess the generational case is the other reason we're doing this. You know, belonging to the generation, as I do, that has come to be defined as the school shooting generation. I was in high school when Columbine happened. The generation that's going to be dealing with the impacts of climate change, a generation that stands to be the first in history to be worse off economically than our parents.
And a generation gets a bad rap about not being involved enough. Or is it a bad rap? What do you think?
I think it's pretty unfair, especially since we were the ones who provided most of the troops after 9/11. We were the ones who helped change the script of our election outcomes in 2018, certainly in 2008 and 12. But it is true that there are a lot of young people who feel disconnected from the political process. It's not that they don't care about the world around them. It's that they're wondering whether the political process has anything to offer them. And if we don't attend to some of the basic conditions of our democracy, from money in politics to the way districts are drawn to the undemocratic character of something like the Electoral College, then we can expect to continue to see young people who very much care about the world around them to question whether the political process has anything to offer.
Well, you've talked in your campaign about the importance of perhaps doing away with the Electoral College, or at least considering doing away with the Electoral College. And you've talked about a lot of other things. You talked about redistricting, about, D.C. and Puerto Rico being perhaps a full part of the United States, unlike what is presently the case, getting money out of politics, like I said before, and also maybe getting rid of United Way. All of these things certainly appeal to progressives. Where do you stand on the Green New Deal?
Citizens United, I think you mean. Way I'm a fan of, Citizens United.
Thank you for that correction. I did definitely mean
you might get some phone
Citizens
calls about
United.
That.
No, United Way is a good cause.
Sorry, the question was about...
Yeah, the question is, where are you in the Green New Deal?
Green New Deal. Look, I think the Green New Deal is the right framework. We need to be honest that it's more a set of goals than it is a plan in its current form. But what I think the New Deal gets right, and the reason I think it's so important, is that it recognizes climate for the national emergency that it is. We're talking about an issue that has the same destructive power as a depression or a war. So why wouldn't we mount a commensurate national effort to deal with something like that? And the great thing about the New Deal metaphor for talking about how we're going to confront climate is it also acknowledges the economic opportunity that lies in getting it right. If you think of part of how we got out of the Great Depression was mobilizing to deal with World War II, and then you say, okay, maybe it shouldn't require a war to have that kind of national effort work through our economy to deal with a major challenge. And again, belonging to a generation that's going to be on the business end of these climate issues for the rest of our lives, why wouldn't we mount the kind of national effort that we have in the past on anything from the space race to a major national security threat in order to deal with this?
But you've said some things about healthcare that are interesting, that seem to be pulling back a bit from, I mean, you're talking about a path. You say, as some people, let's be careful about this. We can't move to it right away with single payer and total healthcare.
Well, I think Medicare for All is the direction we need to move in. I also think that anybody who proposes it has a responsibility to explain how we're supposed to get there, because you don't just flip a switch overnight and expect it to work. So the approach that I think makes sense is what you might call a beginning with a Medicare for All Who Want It. In other words, create a version of Medicare, make it available as a sort of public option on the exchanges, invite people to buy into it. And if people like me are right that this is going to be preferred to the corporate model, more and more people will buy into it, and it'll be a very natural glide path toward a single-payer environment. We've got to remember the reason why we're proposing Medicare for All isn't just because we like the idea of a public role. It's because it would be more efficient. People say, how are you going to pay for this? We already are. And I'll tell you, as a mayor, just with a lot of employees in our city workforce, we're watching the escalating cost of healthcare. And for a country that does much worse than our peers, not only in health outcomes, but in the efficiency of our system, the dollars that go into bureaucracy instead of patient care. Today, in our heavily corporate system, we've got to confront the fact that there's a better way.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Pete Buttigieg. He is a candidate for the presidency and would like to be, in fact, the next president of the United States, Democratic presidential candidate, author of The Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge, and A Model for America's Future. He's leaning in on the youth vote and actually told Stephen Colbert, well, I have more government experience than Trump, more executive experience than Mike Pence, former governor of Indiana, his state, and more military experience than anybody except any of the previous presidents except George H.W. Bush. If you have questions for him or if you'd like to join us and talk to him, you can do that now. Let me give you the toll-free number to join us at. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, welcome your thoughts, as well as your questions or comments. 866-733-6786, toll-free. You can also join us by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You also got, I mean, not only having served in Afghanistan, you also have some history working in industry, management consultant.
Yeah, yeah. I worked in on energy logistics for a brief period. I was actually an expert on North American grocery pricing. And, you know, in that process, I learned about what can be achieved in the private sector. The challenge I think we have now is not simply a challenge of capitalism. It's a challenge of crony capitalism and what happens when you see, frankly, the beginnings of a breakdown in the rule of law to where money equals power. I'm under no illusions about the productive power of the private sector. And we worked very hard in South Bend to establish that our community was open for business at a time when we had gone years without the right kind of economic development opportunities to really grow our city. But we are in a moment where I think for my generation in particular, there will be a crisis of confidence in capitalism if we can't demonstrate that it can make everybody better off and not just the few.
And you want to reform asylum. What do you in that camp that says abolish ICE?
You know, for my dime, it doesn't matter what the agency doing border enforcement is called. What matters is the policies that they have been handed. So when you look at things like family separation, that is a grossly immoral and harmful policy. And, you know, changing the agency in charge of border enforcement is neither necessary nor sufficient. What I care about is getting the policy right. Look, as long as we're going to have borders, we're going to have some kind of agency tasked with enforcing them. But we've got to make sure that this is done in a humane way, in a way that is consistent with American values, and in a way that elevates rather than diminishes our reputation as a great country and a welcoming country.
Should President Trump be impeached?
He probably deserves it, but frankly, and you know, we'll have to see what these reports and investigations come back with. But I think that for the good of the country, what I would really like to see happen is a decisive rejection of Trumpism at the ballot box. So whether he needs to be impeached, I think, is largely a legal question and a constitutional question and in some ways a political question for the Congress to take up. But if we really want to relegate that divisive, harmful style of politics to the dustbin of history, I think it would serve us well to see it thoroughly defeated in an election.
Well, I can tell you one thing that's very refreshing about your campaign, and you bring this up in the book, is the emphasis you put on values, particularly on words like freedom and what they ought to mean and the everyday quotidian life of citizens and all the rest of it. But also, you talk about Make America Great Again as a slogan which is, frankly, false and dishonest from your perspective and should not be embraced.
I come from a community in the industrial Midwest that lost thousands of jobs, that was on a list of dying cities at the beginning of the decade. And the idea that greatness for us lies in turning backward it's an actively harmful idea. The way we changed our economic fate in South Bend was by recognizing change, acknowledging that the future wasn't going to be like the past, insisting that it happened in a way that makes workers better off, and moving forward together. But we had to have a very painful, intellectually honest discussion about how some of the old factories weren't coming back, but we were, and that was okay. I believe you cannot have an honest politics that revolves around the word again. And I think that's the core falsehood in this presidency and this his campaign. We need a politics that does, in my view, have a conception of what greatness is in America, but situates it in the everyday, that American greatness comes from the possibilities in everyday American life. And if we're failing there, if we're letting people down, if we allow it to remain the case that the best place in the world to live out the American dream is Denmark, then we are letting what is great about America slip through our hands.
Well, I want to get to our callers. Lots of questions for you. Before I do, though, you really think you got a shot?
I don't see why not. Look, I get that this is an underdog project. I get that this is a non-conventional background.
And it takes you away from your mayoral responsibilities.
It's a challenge.
You've been in New Hampshire. You've been in Iowa.
Yeah,
right?
There's a lot of road time, and we got to balance that. But I stay involved. We have a great team. We just passed an important policy last night on rental inspections in the city that I'm very proud of. There's a lot of multitasking, and you know, anybody, almost everybody who runs for president has a very important day job that places demands on their time too. Look, I wouldn't be in this if I didn't see a path, and the path involves beating expectations early on and developing a real movement that believes in generational change.
Is America too homophobic for a gay president?
I think there's only one way to find out for sure.
Let's find out what our callers have to say or ask, and we begin with Gustav. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have to start. I love your ideas on health care and changing the health care system. What are your thoughts on the universal basic income, the type being proposed by candidates like Andrew Yang?
So I think it's a timely conversation, especially because the future of work is changing. We just can't count on a lifelong relationship with a single employer the way we used to. I think much of the solution to that relies in making sure benefits are portable, making sure everybody does get access to health care regardless of their workplace. But we may have to look at income smoothing or guaranteed income too. I would like first to see the results of some of the experiments underway today, including one here in California that's going on in Stockton. But I think we need to be open to this, whether it's structured as tax credits or, you know, there's a negative income tax proposal that goes all the way back to the Nixon days. So this actually is not as exotic as it's being made to sound. The bottom line is we need more economic security for Americans. Far too many of us don't have $400 to get through an emergency. And the insecurity that comes from that is very damaging. Time and again, policymakers like me find ourselves working on some elaborate policy contraption to help deal with something like, reading rates in third grade, when the research would suggest that a family would be better off and you would better meet that goal by simply making them a little less poor. So I think it's time to have the conversation. I don't think the conversation's been settled by evidence yet, but it's one that belongs on the table.
Let me thank Gustav for the call. We're going to go right to some more calls here, but we haven't even touched on foreign affairs. You were in Afghanistan. It seems in many people's minds now that it may be imminent that the Taliban will take over Afghanistan. How do you feel about that, and what should be done perhaps in response?
Well, I believe today the next round of talks is happening in Doha with Taliban representatives. I think that they're coming to the table and saying that they are serious about putting down their arms is an encouraging sign. Which
may be a harbinger of their taking over, as I said.
Well, that's why I think we need to make sure that the Afghan government is actually at the table. I'm concerned that we're negotiating with them, and the democratically elected Afghan government seems to be kind of an afterthought or a third party. I don't think anybody wants to see Afghanistan go back to the Taliban rule. But I think core American interests have to do with simply making sure that it is not a threat to the American homeland. We cannot be the guarantor of democracy and prosperity in that or any other country.
It was a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda. That was really what got us
in. And again, that's our core interest, and that's why you can expect to see at least some kind of special operations or intelligence presence, if only to protect the American homeland. But look, you could be old enough to enlist today and not have even been alive when 9/11 happened. And sooner or later, we have to recognize that we cannot continue down the path of endless war.
Here's Helen. Helen, join us. You're on.
Hi. I would like to ask what your offerings for cyber expertise are. And by the way, I'm a Midwesterner, formerly Hoosier from Indiana, and I now live in California. And I respect Midwestern toughness. So whatever your offerings for cyber expertise or cyber war now, because that's where we are.
Well, thank you for raising that, and we'll still claim you as a Hoosier even as you've come out west.
I think Kurt Vonnegut said, once a Hoosier, always a Hoosier.
Exactly.
Look,
I think it's really important. One of the reasons I'm getting into this conversation is I think we need a more 21st century discussion about what security means. I mean, the idea that you can make America safe by putting up a wall from sea to shining sea ignores the fact that you can't put up a wall to deal with cyber threats that are clear, present, and underway. There are a suite of things that we should be doing as a country in order to be harder targets for cyber attacks. A lot of it is the human factor. So in the same way that We are taught how to take common sense steps that make us less likely to be victims of crime in the same way that we do fire drills. We need to learn from an early age and have this part of our education system how not to be vulnerable to things like phishing attacks and other cybersecurity threats, because the weakest link usually still is the human side and making a mistake or being taken advantage of. We also have to include this in our security framework. So when a hostile foreign power takes a cyber attack on us, whether it's our democracy or something else, we need to respond with the full suite of options that we would if there were another kind of attack or threat. It doesn't necessarily have to be tit for tat, although we need to make sure we have both defensive and offensive capabilities in cyberspace. But it also means that we are ready with basically a framework or a rubric of proportionate responses by way of sanctions or other measures that would kick in the face of any cyber attacks. Because the reality is, the reason we haven't seen more of them isn't that it's not technically possible. It's the security framework that says that if somebody harms us, we will respond.
It's technically all too possible. Unfortunately, we've done programs on it. And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Democratic presidential candidate and mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. He's also the author of a book called The Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. A tweet from Stephanie: please tell Pete Buttigieg that let him know that the mom of a veteran who died after his service in Kandahar is very pleased to see that he is out there doing great things.
Well, thanks. That's really moving. And you know, so many families have given so much. I want to make sure we honor and recognize that sacrifice.
A question from a listener named Luke. How do millennials take control of the terms of the climate debate when elderly ostensible allies like Dianne Feinstein take the conservative position? I'm not sure what the conservative position is. There's also the climate denying position, which we have in the White House.
Right.
But I'll respond to that.
Well, I do think that the most powerful advocates for climate action are the people who are going to be dealing with it. And by definition, the longer you're planning to be here, the more you're going to have a personal stake at that. I talk often about trying to picture the world as it'll be in 2054. That's the year, I think, that I hit the current age of the current president. And if you're picturing the conditions there as something you have a personal stake in, then I do think it shapes the sense of urgency that you have around this issue. I think it's an issue that we've known for far too long is impending, and it's always been treated like someone else's problem. But I will tell you, one of the things I've found, especially as I'm going to these early state gatherings, living rooms in Iowa and New Hampshire, that this generational message is appealing not only to people my age and younger, but to people my parents' age and older who really care as a matter of justice and as a matter of legacy about the world that they are passing on for the future.
We'll take another call from Kevin, who is you're an early donor of Pete's, Kevin. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, totally. Mr. Buttigieg, huge fan. I was very excited to see you talking about the possibility of packing the courts a little while ago.
That got a lot of attention, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah, I was wondering if that issue catches momentum and if we have an unfortunate circumstance where Trump wins and the Republicans win control of the House, and if they do choose to pack the courts, what implication that could have on LGBTQ rights, immigrant rights, and any other situations.
Yeah, thanks for that. It really is. You're painting a picture that reminds us what's at stake in every election, but also what's at stake in the trajectory of the courts.
Let's clarify first. So you didn't actually say, I'd like to pack the court.
No, you know, I got a question about it at an appearance a couple of weeks ago, and packing the courts meaning, you know, continuing to appoint additional
justices. What FDR
did. Yeah, basically what FDR tried. You know, you could have 11 justices, for example, as a way to respond to the theft of a seat in the past. And I simply said this is an idea that shouldn't be laughed out of the room because we've got to do something. We've got to entertain ambitious structural reforms. I take these issues seriously because it's a matter of personal freedom for me. The most important thing in my life, my marriage, exists by the grace of a single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court. And there is the likelihood or at least possibility of a rear guard action as the American people and eventually the American Congress catch up to reality that the American judiciary will pull us back. I don't know whether the court packing solution is the right one or not, but what I know is that we have to take steps and have a mature national debate about what it would take to make sure that the Supreme Court does not continue to become the nakedly political institution that it's increasingly viewed as, and that we not have every nomination, every vacancy turn into this apocalyptic ideological battle. So there are several different ways you could do it. One is to add more justices in a way that makes it more likely in the long run that that the balance of the court will reflect the balance of the American people. But, of course, that doesn't really depoliticize the process fully. I've seen other proposals floated that are very interesting. One would be to simply rotate up people from the appellate bench on a temporary basis and let them handle the cases. Another would be to have the court actually have 15 members, five appointed by Democrats, five by Republicans, and the other five appointable only by unanimous consensus among the other 10. So there are some elegant solutions that are being proposed, some of which, interestingly, could probably be done without amending the Constitution. A lot of this stuff is just in statute. I'm not saying we should take it lightly. What I'm saying is that given that in this moment, we are seeing tests to the question of whether American democracy is really capable of handling 21st century challenges. We need to take every step we can to reinforce our democracy. And that includes asking questions about whether the Supreme Court has the right number of justices, whether the House has the right number of representatives, or even whether the U.S. has the right number of states, which is why I talk about D.C. statehood and what it would take for our fellow U.S. citizens in territories like Puerto Rico to have equal and adequate representation.
Listener tweets, will Pete use his time at the debates, assuming you're in the debates, to push the constitutional reforms he's mentioned, i.e. filibuster and adding Supreme Court justices? Does he also support increasing the number of House reps?
There you go. So the question kind of anticipated. Yeah, I think we need to, again, the House of Representatives is not, that scale is not set in the Constitution. It was Congress updated it every few years. And then one day they stopped at 435. And it's not obvious that that's the right number.
You're kind of talking about changes that would come into focus in terms of what the pragmatic needs are, or what the time and the zeitgeist dictates.
The purpose of these changes is to make sure that we continue in the direction of our democracy becoming more democratic. Every generation except mine has seen America move in the direction of more democracy, whether it's moving access to the vote beyond landowners, or women's suffrage, or the direct election of senators, or the Voting Rights Act. My lifetime, I think, is the first in American history when we've really seen this rolled back, when it's become harder to vote, when there seems to be one party that actively trying to diminish the extent to which U.S. citizens exercise this vote that I like to tell myself it was one of the things I was fighting for when I signed up to serve in the military. So the bottom line is the condition of our democracy must be improved, and we should entertain ambitious means to do it.
Hardly even seconds left, but when you're talking about tentative possible changes and so forth, Birch Bayh comes to mind, and he did to
yes.
yours.
Yes, Senator from Indiana authored many amendments. The ERA sadly didn't pass, but the 25th Amendment did. So did lowering the voting age to 18, and we're a better country for it.
Pete, good to have you with us. Good luck on the hustings.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you being with us. That's Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. He's mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and the author of The Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. Thank you for being with us on Forum this morning. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.